Hey there, folks. Welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast, the podcast all about why being alive is more interesting than people think it is. My name is Alex Schmidt. I'm also known as Schmitty the Clam. I'm also known as Schmitty the Champ. And I am also speaking to some of you through the Cracked.com YouTube channel. Hello, YouTube. We are now cross-posting the full audio of these podcast episodes to YouTube. That's a new thing, starting with this one, and I think that's great. That is the one and only message I want to get across about this. It's just great. It's a whole new platform we can reach at. And I think today's episode is great and also very straightforward. Our topic is how bizarre, or great, will the 2020 election be? One more time, that is, how bizarre, or great, will the 2020 election be? Pretty self-explanatory. How is the U.S. federal election for president and Congress shaping up? Plus, how will voting work when there's potentially an ongoing pandemic? Also, I have two programming notes about this episode. One is that we taped the show this past Wednesday, so a lot of the tragic police-incited violence happening on top of coronavirus had not happened yet. And this episode is forward-looking to November, topic-wise. Like, that's what we're focused on. So the facts and figures and everything are still accurate. It's still the same polls and situations. But it does not touch on the past few days' violence, even though I'm sure that's at the front of many of your minds, so please don't be surprised when it doesn't come up. Second programming note, I am joined by two amazing guests this week. Also, one was not able to join us right away. So what's going to happen is you'll hear me in conversation with the amazing comedy writer, editor, and more, Sarah Pappalardo. Sarah is co-founder and co-editor of the satirical comedy site Reductress.com and a regular on the great political comedy podcast Fake the Nation. So I speak with them first, and then you will hear this sound effect. Yes, that was a wacky sound effect. We are a comedic podcast, you know? And that sound will indicate that Sarah and I are now joined by another guest. Their name is Dave Weigel. And Dave is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post and writes an amazing biweekly newsletter there called The Trailer that sums up the most important nitty-gritty of the entire national campaign in a great and detailed way. These are the two best people to dig into this with, so let's get to digging. Please sit back or check the footnotes of this episode because they will let you know your state's policy on voting by mail. And either way, here's this episode of the Cracked Podcast with Reductress's Sarah Pappalardo and The Washington Post's Dave Weigel. I'll be back after we wrap up. Talk to you then. As we look at the election, I feel like I had like a super different expectation of it maybe around January, February. I was like, okay, it'll be just messy and hard. Trump will run on how good the economy is, and that'll be that. And now, I don't know if we'll even, like, show up to places to vote, you know? Like, we'll vote, but I don't know if we'll all do it by mail or what.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like right now it is state by state, and it, to me, seems like it will be chaos. But the thing that concerns me the most is Trump sowing mistrust around the whole idea of mail-in voting. So regardless of whether states have it or not, like, there's just going to be so many minor conspiracy theories around it that he will take that and run.
We planned this topic a little while ago, but we're taping mere hours after Twitter fact-checked Donald Trump for the first time. How do you feel about Twitter, obviously big government, coming in and giving him a fact check?
I mean, I'm glad because I do think that between the people who are like yelling that it's bad and cheering because it's good are people who will be like, oh, that is wrong. And I do think that there's like a net gain from that. It's not a violation of free speech. I do think that overall it's a good thing. And anyone who's crying First Amendment really needs to read what the First Amendment says.
As we look ahead at the election, the latest news right now, CNN on May 26th, said that coronavirus cases are rising in 17 U.S. states, and the president is obviously yelling on Twitter to try to prevent people from voting by mail as maybe a way to have the election as safely as possible. I'm curious, since you're in New York in particular, like, how safe would you feel going out to, because I believe New York, you can't vote by mail normally, like you have to have a reason or an excuse or something. How would you feel going out to a polling place like at this stage, not knowing exactly how it'll be in a few months?
I mean, I would really prefer not to. I, you know, of course I could, you know, put on a lot of PPE. But I mean, the thing is in 2016, I still have photos from 7 a.m. in Clinton Hill where I was in line for 4 hours outside. And that was just to get in the door. I mean, I can't imagine what that would be like with social distancing or any kind of reasonable measures taken. So, I mean, it just seems like a violation of voting rights to begin with to not only have that problem in normal times, but then adding on any kind of required safety. This is just like unethical on so many grounds. So, no, I will go out of my way to vote by mail because why wouldn't you? Like, why would anyone choose to put themselves in that for a vote that honestly will count very little in the grand scheme of the Electoral College? Like, it's insane.
Right. That's also, I wouldn't be surprised if we have hugely depressed turnout in the states people view as like in the tank for one or the other candidate. Like New York will probably go to the Democrat. So I don't know. Why risk it? Millions of people will say.
Right. Which is a bummer. I mean, it really tests, and you know, I think the New York primary is doing this as well, is kind of testing why we vote. Do we vote symbolically or do we vote for a utilitarian purpose, you know, to get the person you want elected? This pandemic is really bringing to light, like, a lot of the voting we do is symbolic, not utilitarian. And it sucks. It really sucks. It sucked before this, and it sucks so much more now when you're risking your life just to exercise a freedom with no net gain. It sucks.
And that little fun sound effect you just heard means Dave Weigel has joined us as well. Dave Weigel from the Washington Post. Hello, Dave.
Hello. Good to be here. Yeah. It turns out time zones are complicated. I forgot about that during the quarantine while I had nothing to do but be inside and make calls. So thanks for bringing me on. Sorry it took me a couple minutes.
Well, and Dave, with you, I'm curious if you've been traveling lately or at all, because you're reporting, you especially in the past, have gone to all these different states and caucuses and things, and now I'm curious how that works.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't. There's not really anything to cover in person. The last trip I did was in Ohio on the 28th of April, so a month ago. There was the Ohio primary basically got kicked back 2 months because of the pandemic. Month and a half. They finished it on April 28th. Their candidates in this primary were still doing a little bit of public events, but not much. I mean, really just showing up at the site where you could turn in your ballot. You know, if you haven't mailed it yet, you can just drop it off on one of these designated election sites. They were just waving from a distance from people, and that was about it. There's not much traditional campaign to cover. It's all phone calls and stuff now. So just the whole lifestyle, frankly, that I had beyond the reporting, which has changed a lot, just the George Clooney up in the air flying all the time lifestyle has been very altered. And in some ways it's liberating because there's a lot more to write than just candidates showed up here and they gave a speech. I've had to do a little more digging than before, a little more data analysis, and then reporting on whether the election will be conducted fairly. That's important. And I end up writing a version of that story every week, not because I have no ideas, because it keeps changing. But yeah, I've barely been traveling.
Wow. I feel like so many candidates go into running for one of these offices, from president to the littlest thing, and they're like, I will do the best ground game, knocking on doors, assembling volunteers. And now they just have to like tweet. Like, that's kind of it, I think.
Totally. I mean, I talked to a candidate yesterday who's running in Maryland, like 45 minutes away from me. And for example, I mapped out where the candidate was. I figured I could drive there. I offered to just drive and, you know, if you need to have me 6 feet away with a mask and talking to her, that's fine. And she actually, because of a medical issue, she had not been outside her house. She joked with me, she can't find her car keys because she has not used her car in so long. And her whole premise was going to be, I'm taking out an incumbent with this amazing ground game that's going to overwhelm him. And she just can't do it. You people convert their supporters to phone calls and texts and things of that nature. But there's a reason people were going door to door and having conversations. So they thought it was effective. Not a magic cure-all. I mean, it was not enough for Bernie Sanders to win some states where he had a huge army of people doing that and Joe Biden didn't have any. But on the margins, it's supposed to help. And a lot of these congressional races I cover, I mean, the next couple months are a ton of primaries with congressional races. A lot of that is about a 20,000, 30,000 turnout race where you turn out another 1,000 and you win. That cannot be done right now. That's actually a big complication that I run into in everything I've been covering over the last couple months at this point. It's a lot of just watching the debates because the debates are still happening via Zoom. I mean, a lot of just sitting down, frankly, because there's not something happening secretly. There's not a bootleg canvassing operation that I'm not finding out about because I'm stuck here. So it's just going to be a very different type of story about the mail they're sending, the outreach they're doing, the ads they're running, things like that, and not so much about in-person action. One thing you've seen in this whole crisis is people chasing the information that they find most agreeable to them. You see in polls, big divergence in, would you take a vaccine if it was released, or would you wear masks outside? And you can see partisan gaps forming. You can see people kind of going into their silos. And the theory of canvassing and actual campaigning is that you are at least having conversations. Maybe there are people who are inclined to vote for you if they heard about you, but at least you're having some conversations pulling people out of the cocoon. And there's none of that happening right now. I mean, everyone's choosing their cocoons and sticking with them until they come out again.
Right, which like only leaves turnout to really change the game. And now when, you know, state by state, it's so iffy whether, you know, what turnout means, whether it's showing up the polls or mailing in or whatnot, like it's hard to nail down a cohesive strategy to get people to turn out.
No, totally. I mean, I check with all these campaigns and say, what have you found that works? And there's nothing magic. It's just they had a network. I mean, some campaigns were in different positions because everybody, you know, the musical chairs stopped at the same time for everybody. But there were some people like in California where you were done already or mostly done because of the runoff system, there's races that don't finish till November. And then there was stuff where they barely were getting started. The primary is coming up, frankly, in New York. AOC has been, just to focus on her because I'm working on that most recently, she's been focused on turning out, creating a grand game and stuff, but hasn't turned all her attention to it. That was going to happen maybe a month ago, and you haven't been able to do. Cut then to primaries that are going to happen in September and stuff. And I'm just talking about the primaries because we will happen, we'll have results. That's separate from the presidential election where everybody's frozen. I mean, the Trump campaign's frozen in ways that they'll admit. They were having rallies in part so that people would show up. And it might sound counterintuitive that you might not vote, but you'll wait 4 or 5 hours in line for a rally. But there were people they claim showing up at the rallies who had not voted in 2016 or 18. They had their info. They were going to hit them. Not 100% they'll vote again, but they're at least finding people. Like they're casting a net out, and they can't cast the net anymore because nobody's coming out. I mean, that's among the reasons why the Trump campaign has been much more vocal about getting things back than the Biden campaign. It's one of many reasons. I mean, it all stems from people saying, look who the president is, he should fix this. But the immediate political reason is that it's less of an issue for Biden. I would say it is an issue for voters they thought they could win. Maybe they weren't going to reach them today, but the old voter registration drives, the going to a campus and signing people up, going to a supermarket parking lot, sign people up, that just can't happen right now. And states have deadlines that are getting tangled up in court because who knows if there's maybe 50,000 people in a key state that might have signed up this summer and won't because no one reached out to them. It's a lot of scrambling to figure out how to at least mitigate the damage of the pandemic and at least create the kind of electorate they thought. Because a lot of elections is actually about creating the electorate that you want.
Yeah.
For Democrats, I should say, much more in people out. For Republicans, especially in the last couple of weeks, it's a lot more, let's file a lawsuit so that these laws are not changed so much that it's easy to vote by mail. That's like the story of the moment.
I hear things like that, and I just one of those strategies is so much nobler than the other strategy. Like, I feel like it's openly reported, and everybody's like, well, those are the two. Pretty normal.
Yeah, you have to be careful about it. I mean, because everyone uses the rhetoric of, I want people to vote. The Republican version of this at the moment is basically getting to election day as a kind of sacred institution, as a thing where everyone should be willing to stand in line and you have more faith in the process. Although at the same time, they've been training people to go to the polls and issue challenges if they think a voter is voting illegally. And you don't need a premise for that. You can just say, that person might be a Democrat. Let's challenge and make sure they're registered here. They were planning that, whereas the Democrats' message is, yes, election day, elections are right. Doesn't matter what election day is. they have a pretty good piece of rhetoric, and that the president himself, his spokeswoman, neither of them vote in person. They vote by mail. But you're right. One of them is generally about how do we get as many people voting as possible on the theory that more of the country will vote for us. And the other one is we know the electorate that we need to win. Let's not risk 50,000 more people who wouldn't have voted getting a mail ballot and going the wrong way. They're very different. It's something you have to, I think, be wary of as a journalist is not say one party claims fraud and the other party disagrees. You have to kind of investigate, okay, what is the claim based on? And that gets thorny, and it can be distracting from like just the lawsuit itself, the laws itself. Again, not as fun as driving around the state and talking to people and sampling some local food at night, but I read lots of these lawsuits and get stories out of them. And they're very revealing in what the two parties think the election should look like. I mean, Republicans emphasize that absentee voting is unsafe because look at this story from 3 years ago of absentee ballots that were found in this box and were used for fraud. Therefore, we can't ever have this. There's a lot of that argument happening. And frankly, all of it is below the TV president messaging from day to day. When he talks about voting rights, sure, I write about that. Some of the ongoing fights, like the Joe Scarborough thing and whatnot, I don't see evidence that voters are paying a lot of attention to that. Those days, I'm usually writing about something else.
Probably the only reason I'm still on Facebook is to see what memes random family members and friends from high school are still posting. And one about stopping voting by mail. I think the position was just that, like, we wait in line in Lowe's and Walmart, so why can't we wait in line? Because, like, hard workers are willing to go out and vote, which is just, like, such a weird, interesting, I think, take, like, very Republican, hard work, bootstraps mentality, but just makes no sense when you actually think about it. And I also had a cousin suggest that there's a conspiracy among the postal union in Washington that they would be willing to rig an election because voting by mail is widely accepted available.
Not to me the whole conversation about this, but in covering it too, one thing I've always liked to do that I think has benefited me when I hear something kind of curious, I just have to chase down where the claim came from. Or I see a video, I'm like, I wonder what they said before and after the clip ended. And you've seen a lot recently of videos of Democrats who are still in politics, you know, Barack Obama, Jerry Nadler, et cetera, being asked about mail voting and saying some problem with it. But the problem they're describing is a thing that, for example, Oregon and Washington have fixed already, which is, oh, geez, what happens if you send every registered voter a mail ballot? What would happen to, you know, the 300,000 people who just don't want to vote that year? They figured it out. There's signature checks on the ballots to get returned. They call back voters and challenge them if they think there's something wrong with it. Nothing is perfect, but they've got very limited fraud because people will take a clip from when they were debating how to do this fairly and leave out how they did it. It's like taking a clip from 1963 about how we could possibly get to the moon and be like, well, see, people are still worried about how we get to the moon. They're not. They figured it out.
It's really hard to fight one person's opinion with any sort of fact that would believe that a postal union conspiracy would actually go undetected for decades.
And people do persecute this crime. So I think what people have to be careful in not saying this system is 100% safe and has never failed, so let's just do it, and more, here's how we can do this emergency system. And I think this is an area, there's a lot of debate, especially on the left, about whether Democrats lose because they always compromise. So far, now I'm not sure what will get passed in the next rescue package, stimulus package, what have you, but the Democratic response has really been, let's ask for basically everything we want on voting rights, and then maybe it gets whittled down to, okay, well, at least here's a couple billion dollars so that every state has the money for absentee ballots. And that's not as good to them as same day registration, automatic registration, things like that. But if they get one piece of that by swinging really hard, I think Democrats would go into the election with more confidence. It's a weird thing to cover because on the one hand, there are more than 5 months until the election. There's about 4 months until some states have early voting start, which seems like a lot of time, but we've already burned a third of the time we had before the election already and not fixed many of these problems. But if you don't want to be worried all the time about it, a lot of states have been moving fast on this, even Republican states where the president has his official position is that they shouldn't make it easier. It's really all but six states in the deep South. The only one that's kind of competitive is Texas. And even then, it's like arguably competitive. That, those are the only ones that are still fighting to, you can't even request an absentee ballot unless you prove you might die from coronavirus. There's only a few of those. The rest of the states have been moving pretty in a pretty unified direction towards, let's make it pretty easy to request a ballot. That's not what reformers want, but it's like, that's better than there possibly being millions of people who just are unable to vote in November and they have no other option.
I'm amazed to learn when I talk to people in any other state, which is part of why I'm excited to be Zooming with you guys, that kind of every state has always been trying to like invent how voting works on its own. And so then we have this system where not only are there states that are making it weirdly hard to vote by mail, even with this pandemic happening, but even before it happened, five states, Hawaii, Washington, Oregon, Colorado, and Utah, already defaulted to voting by mail, and then 29 states and Washington, D.C. allow voters to request an absentee ballot with no excuse and no particular reason given. So that's a majority of the states already had some kind of voting by mail system set up before this even happened, which is like, I don't know, maybe a positive way to look at our otherwise kind of broken system.
One of many things, we just have 50 systems. We have 51 because D.C. gets to vote for president, too. And they're subtly different. And there's not one document everyone said, okay, we're going to base it off of this and change it. I mean, some of these are decades old and have no provision in case there's a crisis, and which is a little bit odd when you think about it, because we've literally gone through this before. 102 years ago, we had the Spanish flu, which I didn't realize until this crisis actually started in America. So that's really good branding by America to blame it on Spain. Like, we actually started this flu, but you would think, oh, maybe there's some kind of dusty book in the state capitol that says what to do when there's a pandemic. But nope, like, we're all inventing it over again. And to be fair, election systems have changed a lot. And to, you know, be even more fair, there was a lot more fraud in elections, like, until honestly the last 50 years, between people not being allowed to vote. The famous stories, like the Gangs of New York things, where people are shaving their beards to vote as different people, that used to happen. But we don't really have the same rule for everybody. So you kind of, even as a reporter, I've just had to build a spreadsheet and update it on how each state works. Oof. And the extra act of getting a thing in the mail and sending it back in, one thing we found is, frankly, people under 40 don't mail anything if they can avoid it. I haven't really had to mail anything regularly since I had a rent check, as opposed to I paid a mortgage, so 4 years ago. And there's a worry by Democrats that there's going to be people voting for the first time who just wait and figure out election day is coming and they didn't realize they had to request a ballot. That could happen. I mean, I guess there's limits on what kind of opinions you should have as you cover politics. But I think generally the idea of people not having their votes taken away is pretty good. And if you're worried about that, it's kind of a bracing thing to cover and to encounter for people. It's just one of the more complicated conversations you have with voters. And I think it's good to get them out there and say, look, you know, reasonable people are really confused by this process. How do we fix this?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is like a really interesting opportunity for some creative get out the vote tactics. Like, for me, like, I have to mail a check this week, and it's like the most insurmountable task that I have of all week. And just like the act of giving out stamps, I mean, assuming, of course, voting probably has a self-mailing envelope, but like just the simple task of like rallying around post office boxes, or like, you know, showing post box locations in an app, like a Get Out the Vote app and things like that. Because you can't really pick it near a poll station, but there's no rules about like canvassing around a post office or a box. So I don't know. I mean, it could get weird. It could get fun.
I can see it. Since you just said that, I can see somebody doing like a grassroots stamp campaign to just hand out make sure everybody has a stamp. Like, that's been a big question with a lot of, especially liberals, because each party has big donors, wealthy, like Democratic donors. What if one just said, here's $5 million to make sure everybody who has like some fine in Florida that prevents them from voting can just like pay it, which is actually legal. But you're right. No, there's innovative stuff that hasn't been done. That would be legal if you're not saying who to vote for. If you're just trying to help people pay restitution, like if it's giving to charity, basically. This Florida passed a law to undo kind of what voters did already. Voters said, instead of Florida's current system, where if you have any felony, you need to appeal to a board of five people, and they decide whether you can vote again. It's now, you're fine, as long as it wasn't one of a couple really super violent crimes. And the state Republicans passed a law saying, actually, you need to pay all your associated court fees first. So there were hundreds of thousands of, not even indigent people, just people who didn't have the capital. I mean,
That was deemed an illegal poll tax, right?
Yeah, that just happened this week. But I mean, until this week, people were kind of operating thinking, geez, there might be a ton of people. And who knows who they're voting for? That part of the Constitution was there for so long and they had to amend it. But with a vote was, if a state legislature run by Republicans thought, they'll be fine, let them all vote, they'll vote for us, they would have done it already, and they didn't.
I'm almost thinking we've got this one idea for our insanely wealthy, eccentric listener who could just resolve all of the Florida fees. Like what else would it be good to see someone do in the, like, six or seven states that will decide the whole thing, including Florida? Like, it seems like that's the whole game every year is a couple states, but especially this time when it's hard to go places and do stuff.
Yeah, you mentioned the stamp thing. That's states are going to keep debating how to change this, but you can go to the Brennan Center website, which collects this. I mean, they're kind of a liberal voting rights advocacy group, but they have very useful data what the rule is, which states are going to just send you. I mean, in D.C., I got a presidential ballot, and there's no need for a return stamp on it. It's just like you just drop in the mail.
As we look at sort of the rest of what's going on here, Dave, you do a great newsletter called The Trailer, and you picked out that basically in these primaries, it seems like every established candidate, not just because they don't need the ground game, every established candidate kind of has just sort of a baked-in advantage because campaigning is different now. There's also a thing going on where people seem to think that Joe Biden is particularly bad at the internet, right? Like, he needs us young voters who don't know how to mail stuff to come through for him. Is that true? Is that something that we should worry about, that now that the internet is kind of the only way to campaign, Biden is, maybe because he's more ethical, worse at the internet than the opposition?
Oh, yeah. Well, interesting you put it that way, because so one thing I did, again, trying to adjust this new reality where I can't just go and see what campaigns are doing, is I didn't do the thing where you consume only like one campaign's content for a week. That would be crazy. But I signed up with the Trump app, where you have to put in your name and your phone number. And I signed up with the Biden app, which was the same. So I said, okay, let me set this up where I'm getting all the content I would be getting if I supported the campaign. Although I won't donate. If you donate, you obviously get more and you're added to lists, et cetera. I can't donate to a campaign. I don't want to anyway. And then I will watch their broadcasts for their voters, because they both have been doing special broadcasts for the Trump campaign basically every night, the Biden campaign a little more judicious, that are all exactly what the campaign wants you to hear. And it was super interesting. I'll stick to just the ways they talk to you on the internet, because the Trump campaign really does advertise in ways that are familiar if you're like looking at pop-up windows online.
The famously beloved pop-up window. Yes. Yeah, sure.
Well, so it has lots of, so I was thinking of the Trump one first. The Trump one, just the texts that you get are often offering an emergency deal that's about to end, and clearly that this can't be true. I mean, they so the last few I got were, I was one of 20 chosen to get early access to sign the president's official birthday card. I could be the first name he sees sign in the next hour. That was yesterday evening. A few hours before that, I got one. Trump gold card. President Trump recognized you as being in the top 1% of all text members. Why is your membership inactive? Donate now. And again, this is just somebody. I just signed up with my phone number, and I'm getting some texts. I've not interacted with the campaign any other way. I've not given them money. They're doing the social pressure thing where it's, hey, we know what you're up to. We know your neighbors are watching. But they're doing it with information that's not actually real. And if I was inclined to support a candidate, I'd probably get that and say, yeah, I mean, that seems cool. I could carry around like a gold Trump card in my wallet. Whereas the Biden one, I mean, I won't read you the whole thing, but I just got like a text from the Biden. I shouldn't turn these off, I guess. I'm going to text the Biden one today. And it's, President Obama had a message for Joe Biden supporters. Did you see it? And then it's a paragraph from Barack Obama about donating money. And so, if you can help answer the president's call, help today, chip in to be one of the people in District Columbia he's counting on to respond right away. It's much more, as somebody who's editing the article was like, oh, it's definitely like spam email versus NPR pledge drive. Like, the Biden one is definitely, hey, buddy, you know, if you like great content like Car Talk and Wait, Don't Tell Me, you can chip in a little bit to help Joe Biden. Every bit helps. It's just a very different approach that assumes a different brain pattern almost by the voter, which I found super fascinating. I wasn't sure. I knew this, there'd be like more of a hard sell from the Trump campaign, but it would be that stark.
Yeah, it's a nice like Alex Jones approach. Would you rather watch the 7 o'clock news or Alex Jones? I would make a certain choice, but I think a lot of people just like the candy of anger, I guess. and they love it. Yeah. And it's like it's the same thing with Trump's merch game. Like it's honestly, he's selling so much merch. You know, it's not as much of a one-to-one, like 100% profit or going to fund his campaign, but
a lot more merch. I mean, that's, you kind of have to chase FEC stuff and it's not complete. They self-report like when it's good for them. I'm not sure how many people bought the Trump campaign's hashtag you ain't black shirt, for example. I'll check in like a couple weeks. But like, the straws and the masks and the part of it's that like just the Trump branding, and this is part of the entire Trump ethos and pitch, is it's not just that you want him to win, it's that you also take pleasure in how much he makes the other side angry. Even he has a new ad today as we're talking that refers to the stimulus bill and how like, you know, he might not be popular, but it got done. And actually, he's referring to like a super bipartisan bill. But the frame is people hated it when he did it. So the Trump merchandise is kind of like you advertise how much you're triggering people. And the Biden merchandise is much more kind of happy, shiny. Here's aviators and ice cream and kind of puns about Joe. They had shirts every time somebody would endorse him that have those, you know, someone, ampersand someone, like Kamala and Amy and Pete and Joe, things like that. And just very different in ways that really accentuated how everybody's brains are getting further apart as this campaign goes on.
I'm wondering if this is an election where it's just like clearer than ever already which way people will vote, because you have two very, very well-known candidates, each in their own way. Like Biden, I think, was first elected to the Senate in the early 70s and has been with us ever since.
Yeah.
And then Trump's been on every kind of media it can be. You've got incredibly well-known candidates, incredibly well-known general positions, and also like entire personality types staked out and kind of mindsets staked out. And like, I'm sort of terrified to meet a truly undecided person at this point. It would be fascinating.
Yeah. And people advertise their opinions more than ever in public. I mean, that's why Trump will win so many kind of online shows of force and trends, is because if you're a Trump supporter, it's especially like, get on there, fight for him on social media. When I was covering more specifically conservative activism, and I still cover when it was my beat for a couple of years, there was lots of training, like get on there, get on Facebook, get on Twitter. Just the idea that it's important to the cause if it's clear there's a bunch of people saying the same thing. And I think there's a bit less of that on the left, and there just always has been. I mean, it's the same reason why you can get Fox can succeed and other conservative media networks can succeed, but liberals don't really have one of their own. It's just they're, people are part of a tribe but don't think of themselves in the same way, whereas conservatives are kind of in the current Trump mode, are really into being part of that team and being vocal about, yes, I'm part of this team. The one thing it can do is make you think everybody's doing that. No, there's not. I mean, tens of millions of people are going to vote and could not care less about saying who they're going to vote for, and I'll never post online. And those are the ones I can't talk. I don't know where they are right now because I'm in my house. Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah, because also there's another element here, and I'm mainly drawing on a 538 piece from May 18th about this, but that and some other articles are suggesting that among older people in like their mid-40s, but all the way up through their mid-60s and beyond, among older people, Trump is doing way worse this time around. And I'm not exactly sure why, but it seems like Biden is doing much, much better with those folks. And I'm curious if that'll be decisive. Like maybe that's the kind of thing where like, oh, if we flip Florida and one other state, that's it. Like maybe it's that sort of thing where if we flip the 60-somethings, that's it. It's all decided.
Yeah, and so all polling that's just all voters includes black voters who, whatever the age group, are very, very Democratic at this moment. Latino voters who are overwhelmingly but not as lopsided Democrat. And then Asian voters who increasingly are Democratic. But it's even if you separate out white voters, old white voters really loved Donald Trump in 16, and some of that has faded. And the reporting we've done on it has just found that there really are a lot of older people who are, they don't have particular hobby horses. Some of them just really didn't like Hillary Clinton, and they don't think Trump is a dignified president, and they're voting against him for that reason. Like my colleague Jenna Johnson at the Post had a story from about Floridians, and they kept coming up with that. And there's been even some loss, though, directly because of COVID, because of the sense that there's a crisis happening that's affecting older people, and there's not been a great job done of fixing that. And that's been pretty potent, too. So the worry for Biden is, if the first thing is something he was running on already, it's actually, it annoyed a lot of liberals or people on the left in the primary, because it was, why is he talking about dignity and restoring the soul of the nation instead of passing the best healthcare bill, passing Medicare for all. But that was always his plan, was like, we're going to run on, wouldn't you love a dignified president who's not trying to, you know, distract you all the time. But the other part, the COVID thing, it's not like the virus is going to go away tomorrow, but that's something that Trump could control. He could convince older people that he turned the corner on it. And so that's a little less out of their purview. But it's those two things. They've definitely been weaker with older voters than they expected, and they're not quite sure how to fix it without the pandemic fixing itself.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I was kind of looking at battleground states in 2016 versus 2020 in like Wisconsin and other states. Biden did so much better against Bernie than Hillary did in 2016. And no matter how you look at it, like, you can't not see that something had to do with sexism in this particular generation that I don't think is as present in millennials or younger. It's hard not to see that in this rather than like a genuine love of Biden. You know, I think there are definitely a lot of people older than me that genuinely do love Biden, but I do think that it's not so much that he is performing so much better against Trump. It's just that he's not Hillary Clinton.
That is a big thing that I think a lot of people are reluctant to admit. And a lot of Bernie people I talk to, because they were always getting confronted with, but he's in his late 70s and he's a socialist and he's going to lose. They were correct in saying, well, a lot of the fall off in 16 was people who didn't like Hillary Clinton, and they were never wedded to Trump, and they're totally going to vote for Trump's opponent. And that was true. And I think Biden benefited from that. And he's still benefiting from that, in part because of the idea that I just kind of said it, that Bernie took positions that were going to scare people and Biden didn't. It was that simple. It's just getting hammered in state after state. After those first two states where Biden did poorly, I mean, that really did come back.
It's such a different calculus with like the under 40 crowd that it's like an entirely different discussion. Like, I'm exactly 35. Everyone older than me just seems to be having very different moral quandaries than people younger than me, which is understandable. But yeah, here we are.
Yeah.
We've got a stat here that among voters age 65 and up, Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 13 points. And in polls right now, Biden is doing the same as Trump or even a point or two better. And I wish I knew more 65-year-olds other than my grandparents. Well, they're older than that. But I would really like to know, like, are you guys just not comfortable with a lady running? Like, is that the entire enchilada for you that changes it? Wow.
It is that, but I don't think it's as simple as, like, I don't like her because she's a woman. I mean, this has been litigated already by everyone, but it's very subtle internalized sexism that you and I and everyone, you know, falls victim to varying degrees. And that translates into mistrust and you know, where we are now. But it's hard to show people that because it is kind of an abstraction. It's not as, you know, it's the same conversation around race. It's very, very hard to tell someone of a certain generation that, like, their behavior is sexist when they don't feel sexist.
Right. Maybe this is too large of a question or too much of a thing you guys are in the middle of working on, but Sarah, with Reductress, like, how hard or easy is it to satirically handle that kind of thing with especially this coming election where it seems like, at least at the presidential level, ladies have been sort of sidelined?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been challenging, but now it's harder because of this, especially across generations, this like totally different dialogue that's happening. Because like in the broad middle America sense of like Biden versus Trump, like that's one discussion. But then, of course, like among liberals versus the left, like it's just an entirely different conversation. And, you know, in comedy, we usually rely on some kind of shared truth off of which we make a joke. And there are just so many tinier factions of like micro realities now, even compared to 2016 or 2013. It is hard to make a statement about what's going on that isn't simply like an indictment of how the media covers things. So yeah, it is a challenge, but we will definitely be addressing it in the next 5 months.
Yeah, totally. I'm thinking of how I watched that Michael Jordan documentary recently, and I was like, yeah, shared experience. Oh boy, that was a thing.
That was nice. That was cool. The good old days.
We should look a little bit maybe at not just why people do or do not like Biden, but also I think even before this, it seemed like Donald Trump support was kind of really locked in both ways, right? Like the people who like him, and the people who don't. Dave, are you seeing any, we've got some polls here, but have you seen any signs that maybe this massive weird global pandemic could like shift his support a little bit? Like maybe that can change it?
Well, he's been an outlier. Trump's been an outlier in, if you look at governors, you look at world leaders, the only world leaders or governors who have not had a huge popularity burst are the ones who have been perceived to act slowly and not fix things. And some who presided over pretty bad situations, like the Italian prime minister, even had big popularity boosts at the same time. And it's been fading a little bit as things go on. But it's a very weird political fight to have, because I think, again, because of this assumption of bad faith by a lot of people of what the other side must be thinking, there's the idea that the Trump has said so, that he thinks Democratic governors are just making things worse to hurt him. But if you follow what they're saying, they're often, okay, we hate to do this, here's another week of this, but this week you can go back to your boat. This week you can have a group of 10 people. There's been a desire to ratchet it down. Everyone who's just been kind of going with the pandemic news and then ratcheting down slowly has been doing very well politically, and Trump has not. It's something that Democrats are very nervous by nature, but struck that they weren't even nervous that Trump might respond to this crisis in a way that helped him a lot. But if you push them now and say, you know, why isn't Biden doing better? They'll say, look, this is a crisis where George W. Bush had a higher approval rating for years because of the response to 9/11. This could have been a 9/11, and Donald Trump is not experiencing a rally of people behind him. And this is one thing that's been consistent. Gets back to the whole Biden, I'm going to take us back to what presidents used to be like thing. He just doesn't really do the presidential rhetoric that gets past party. He does tend to bring it back to who was on his side and who wasn't. Even just things like he doesn't invite Democrats anymore to bill signings. There might be some that happened last week and forgetting, but people notice, oh, so there's Democrats who wrote half this bill and they weren't allowed to come to this. So he's not been doing much to reach out to people who might have never liked him before, but then look what he did, with the exception of black voters, and that's complicated. So he's very comfortable with the base and people who applaud for him already, and he's been less politically comfortable with people who don't like him yet. And that has been an issue. I mean, that's really, I think, suppressed some of the support he was going to get, or he could have gotten in a pandemic. Whereas other governors, I mean, just Cuomo's been on TV a lot, and you'd have to look, and you don't, Cuomo has not taken opportunities to say, I won the election. No one thought I could do a good job at this. He just kind of goes through the facts of what is happening. And I think over time, it has really hurt Trump that he didn't seem like he could get over some of his habits in order to govern during a crisis.
Yeah. And I mean, we're still definitely in the fog of war a little bit, but I think you're right. Like, I think the polling bears out that like he has not gained much from his behavior or performance so far. The thing that does concern me, and I hope it doesn't stick, is this pandemic revisionism that's happening, reframing it in the way that like, oh, this wasn't so bad, and it wasn't, you know, it's not happening by me, and it was here by someone else, and like Trump couldn't have done anything about it, because like there is a lot of that rhetoric, and of course it's veering into conspiracy theory, but the very light version of that is something that, you know, a kind of apolitical or kind of not someone who doesn't follow the news might by. And, you know, it's concerning to me that people who don't face this virus directly can't really understand like the abstraction of a number.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm less surprised by that. I'm not happily surprised, but people are very focused on their own well-being and less focused on the well-being of others. That's kind of a biological thing that human history is about combating and changing our behavior. And add to that, people are willing to believe the worst about why something bad is hurting their team. This wasn't my quote, but Tim Alberta, who writes for Politico, was at a Trump visit in Michigan and talked to people online. And among the opinions was, isn't it interesting how once impeachment was over, this virus happened? Which there's a lot of assumptions in there. It also gets past how the virus was being spread in Asia like months before the impeachment trial. But that attitude's out there. You can't really counteract that. And if you have no one in your vicinity being affected by this, you saw this actually 2 months ago in Michigan especially, people were saying, look, I live in a rural county and nothing bad has happened. and I'm being asked to suffer for Detroit or New York. Why is that happening? I mean, it's almost surprising that there's as much cohesion socially as there has been. And there have been protests and people with guns at state capitals. And I'm not trying to be glib about it, but it's been pretty limited. You haven't seen people. Every time there's been a, you know, rogue hair salon open, we've all heard about it. So most people have been pretty, more than politically line up with somebody or the other. It's been like 65 to 70% of people who are ready to get through all these restrictions. And the mask thing's interesting because what happens if we're allowed to mostly return to some lifestyles that we had, but we have to wear a mask? The president behaves as if that's really unpopular. It actually isn't. That's a really popular outcome for a lot of people at the moment. If you can do your things but have to wear a mask for a few months, that seems fine. Politically, you wouldn't know it. It's because the president's against it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to another state for a couple months over the summer, and I'm really curious. You know, I've heard anecdotes about, you know, people judging people who wear masks, like wearing a mask is now a political statement. I'm curious to see if I encounter any of that. I hope not. Mm-hmm. Actually, speaking of Trump merch, one of my favorite haunting pieces of Trump merch I found was a Trump face mask.
Yeah.
Made out of a strange material. Like, it actually looked like a mouse pad was repurposed to be a face mask. Like, they're really making the most of their worst sellers. So that there's that.
Let me tell you, once you can stop using your mouse on the table and start using it up here, oh, baby.
Makes it easy to breathe. Yeah, I almost feel like it's deliberately made difficult to breathe so that you'd be like, this mask sucks. I don't want to wear a fucking mask. Stop oppressing me. So like, so just so they can like burn it or something.
It is very exciting going back to like how the public actually feels about wearing masks and being socially distant. Like, I'm excited how many people are on board with it, because we'll have linked stats about it being in most polls that I've seen well over 80% or into 90% of Americans are good with it. And we don't agree like that on anything in the entire country. Like, we're into maybe keep old consti, the Constitution.
Old consti.
that's like about it. Like, those are the things we're on board with, masks and that.
Mm-hmm. Totally. It's actually kind of inspiring. If you, like me, all you cover is politics, which is all struggle and division. When you find something that reveals, oh, the struggle and division has been a quarter of people yelling at each other and most people are okay with this, that does put it in perspective. I'm not going to pass more judgments, but it does say, okay, what is there anything else that is being looked at as a bitter one-on-one fight that is actually just kind of a crazy distraction? Because maybe we shouldn't write about this. As much as we do.
Yeah, give them less ink and airtime just for standing in a state capitol. And speaking of the states, I'd love to look at the Senate and the House and just get a sense of like how those are going to go.
Yeah.
With the Senate in particular, it seems like Democrats need a net gain of either 4 seats or 3 seats on the vice presidency to take control of it. Yeah. Is that something they could do?
It is. It was always possible at the start of the year. They got a couple of lucky breaks. The unlucky breaks they've had have been pretty minor. So you got the numbers right. The one seat they're worried about losing is Doug Jones in Alabama, because it just Alabama's given every indication. They voted for Doug Jones because he's running against Roy Moore. It doesn't really want him to be senator.
Because 33 seats are up and 23 are held by Republicans. And then of the 10 that Democrats are defending, it seems like the only hard one's Alabama.
That's the only hard one. Michigan has an incumbent Democratic senator who, he's not unpopular, but he's not super well known, Gary Peters, and he made a very smart decision, I think, so far to run a lot of ads early on, reintroducing himself as just, he brings stuff home and he's a veteran, has been the message. And he has an opponent who lost by like 7 points in a Senate race in 18. Republicans are impressed. They did that well, so they got him to run again. He's good at raising money. That one is on the bubble, but every poll has been the Democrat up by like 9 or 10. And it's one of those states where Republicans are nervous that Trump would lose it. And if he's losing it, what's the chance? It's actually very recent, but 2016 was the first presidential year where literally no one got elected to the Senate without their presidential candidate carrying the state at the same time. That's actually been unusual until just now. Voters were just, there was a little bit of split tickets. Like, there were some people who ran ahead of Hillary. There were some Republicans who ran ahead of Trump, but nobody won a state while their nominee lost it. Their presidential nominee lost it. Wow. But anyway, you mentioned the numbers. Those are the two Republican opportunities they're looking at. Notably, they're not even talking that much about Minnesota, where they recruited this one-term congressman to run, and he's raised basically no money. That's a state Trump talks about competing with, but it looks tough. So the rest of the map is mostly Republican states. You have the biggest luck for Democrats is they convinced the governor of Montana, Steve Bullock, to run for Senate when he said he wouldn't. He ran for president instead, didn't do very well, came back to state. And that's one where his response to COVID has been very popular. So Republicans actually just invested $10 million more in ad buys because they're worried about Montana. And then Montana is fairly red. There's bluer states than that. There's Colorado, where the Republicans have been behind up to 10, 15 points all year against the former Democratic governor, John Hickenlooper, who's very popular. There's Maine, where Susan Collins has always been popular, but it's kind of been fading. And they recruited the state speaker of the House, who's not super well known, but they've got they got a real candidate. North Carolina, where they convinced a Iraq War veteran state senator. I keep saying they for Democrats because they're kind of on the offense here. And basically, across the map, there's now Arizona, which has been getting closer and closer, where Democrats are now competing for a presidential election. They convinced Mark Kelly, the former astronaut who's married to Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman who was shot and became a gun safety activist. He's been raising a ton of money, leading in polls. So they have a combination of stuff where if it broke their way, they'd win the Senate. And it looked better for them now than it did like 3 months ago. And it did not change much during the pandemic, apart from Bullock got more popular in Montana. And when it comes to the House, Republicans have some recruits in swing states that are better than the last time. The race they won in California was this like perfect storm where they have a candidate who is really great on paper, a Latino veteran. All his ads were I'm Latino veteran. Here's my story. My opponent hasn't done enough to solve the coronavirus pandemic response. They won that one, but with, about half the turnout of a normal election. But they have a few candidates like him around the country, but not enough right now. They're doing okay with money, but there's some seats they lost in 18. They have not found anyone to contest again. There's some places where they really were targeting somebody and a kind of the wrong candidate won the primary. So there's probably, I'd say, 20 to 25 House seats that are competitive right now on both sides. Republicans recruited. It's not like some years where people were out of power and couldn't find anybody to run for anything. I'd say Republicans are less likely to win the House than Democrats are to win the Senate. And like both are not certain at all right now, but one's right, more likely than the other.
Because if I'm counting things right, it looks like Republicans need to gain about 17 seats to take the House. And they are also polling on a generic ballot from 538. Democrats are up 7.9%, which feels like a lot to me.
That's basically how they won last time. It was by like an 8 margin in 18. Yeah.
Yeah. In 2018, Democrats won the general House vote by 8.6% and gained 40 seats. So if they're running about the same as that, it seems like maybe they keep the House and win the Senate and win the presidency. Maybe that's over optimistic, but that could be a thing that happens.
It could be. I mean, in 16, Democrats actually did pretty good down ballot. There's elections that have been disasters. They got wiped out. And 16 was weird because they actually gained seats in the House and Senate and lost the presidency because of these three close Midwest states. But otherwise, it looked like the kind of election that the party wins the presidency, and it just wasn't. Republicans have more money and organization now. Democrats have fewer advantages on that. They have a candidate who's more popular. So the top of the ballot thing is in this kind of state where if Trump is making it very close or if Trump is winning, even then it might be tougher for Republicans to win the House.
Are things so polarized that we're almost more likely to have full control of the government by one party, right? Like, it seems like this is the kind of thing where if Trump runs great or Biden runs great, it's also swings both houses of Congress, and then just it's a landslide either direction.
It's hard to see this moment. I mean, if the polling was frozen in place, it would be Democrats who have a better shot at that, just because if Biden were to win just the Obama states from 2012 and then pick up Arizona and they won all the Senate races in those states, like according to how it went, then they would have the Senate. They would have picked up Colorado, Arizona, Maine, North Carolina, lost Alabama, and they're in. That is more possible, but it's hard to see how a landslide shapes it, and it's hard to predict it that far out. I mean, one of my colleagues at the Post wrote in 2008, around now, maybe a little bit later in the year, about how Democrats wanted to win 60 seats that year, and it's looking like some stuff's not going their way. And then the financial crisis happened and everything broke their way. But at the moment, it's the way Republicans talk about it, about a wave looking for evidence of a breakthrough. There's a couple things that have happened for them that are pretty decent, but not much evidence that they've counteracted this trend where just, you know, only 44% of the country likes the president, wants him to get reelected, or less in some polls.
Yeah, and it's hard to see, you know, if a second wave of the virus comes in the fall, it's hard to see how that could ever benefit Trump without some kind of massive tampering with democracy, I would hope.
Mm-hmm. That is what people worry about. I think that's why you've seen more worry recently about just whether the election's fair. It's is there a situation where 51% of Wisconsin intends to vote one way, and then, oops, 50,000 voters in Milwaukee have huge problems actually casting ballots. That's what Democrats are more worried about than this or that story of the week. In just talking to Democrats, I don't detect much worry about what's one of the recent ones, like Obamagate, I guess. I don't hear Democrats worrying, oh no, we're going to lose the swing voter because of Obamagate. I do hear them worry, we're going to do all the work, and then there's going to be some shutdown in one of these states that screws everything up. I mean, you hear a lot more of that. And you always hear paranoia, but you hear more because of the pandemic. But it's all from a place of, weirdly for Democrats, like optimism. They think that things can break their way as long as it's fair.
Yeah, I mean, I'm feeling cautiously optimistic, at least. I said it earlier, but I think like the thing I'm most concerned about is just Trump sowing doubt in the validity of the election. But
it's not a thing you do if you're like about to win.
But I mean, if there's one thing that he's proven over and over again, is he is a bit lazy. He does talk a big game about suing states and cutting off funding, but most of the time he likes to do the thing that takes the least amount of effort for the most benefit to him. So sowing discord.
Again, I think I said this before, but a lot of the rhetoric's not matching up. We have a story today about masks and how there's Republican governors who are supporting him who disagree with him. Same thing with voting. You know, he'll sometimes tweet and it's kind of, people look around and say, why is he doing this weeks after Pennsylvania already made it an all-mail election? Like, did he not know that the state already changed this? When he went after Michigan last week, people were saying, okay, he can threaten their funding, but one, how, and two, the state already changed the law, they changed the Constitution, actually, in a ballot measure, but they changed the law. Like, people are just going to get the ballots. He can't screw with that part of it. So it's sometimes, and this is the thing that more panicky liberals worry about, he will make a threat and he doesn't actually have a way to go about it. And if you say, well, he can never do it, you're a Pollyanna, but he's done this before. I mean, it's been 2 years since he said he was going to have an executive order taking away birthright citizenship. And then he keeps finding out he can't and he doesn't do it. So he sometimes does like bluff and it gets covered. But even though the words of the president are collected for posterity and for news, sometimes the coverage does reflect, okay, he said this like six times and he's not done anything about it. And he can't actually move the election deadline without Congress signing off, which they're not going to do. So what should we really be worried about here? I mean, it is a constant struggle between what is the president talking about and what is actually happening. It's not usually this disparate, this far apart.
Yeah, but it is. Oh, boy.
Yep.
What fun to pundit around.
Folks, that is the episode for this week. My thanks to Sarah Pappalardo and Dave Weigel for everything. In our footnotes, you will find our sources for this episode. They are heavy on Dave Weigel's newsletter called The Trailer. Also, you will find a simple link to Reductress.com, the fantastic comedy website co-headed by Sarah Pappalardo. And beyond all that, our theme music is Chicago Falcon by the Budos Band. This episode was engineered by me and our guests and edited by Chris Souza. If you loved this episode, that's great. If you hated it, let me know about it on social media. That's right, social media, a space that had a hell of a lot of important footage on it this past weekend. My own Twitter account tried to, like, stay out of the way. My Twitter account is at Alex Schmitty. My Instagram is at Alex Schmitztagram, and I'm on the wider internet at my website, alexschmitty.com. Sincerely, please reach out there if you'd like to talk to me about the episode. And I'm here to say we will be back next week with more Cracked Podcast. So how about that? Talk to you then.